I'm reading this morning from Luke 21, verses 5 through 19. This can be found on page 915 in the Pew Bible. Some of his disciples were remarking about how the temple was adorned with beautiful stones and with gifts dedicated to God. But Jesus said, "As for what you see here, the time will come when not one stone will be left on another. Every one of them will be thrown down." "Teacher," they asked, "when will these things happen? And what will be the sign that they are about to take place?" He replied, "Watch out that you are not deceived, for many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am he,' and 'the time is near.' Do not follow them. When you hear of wars and revolutions, do not be frightened. These things must happen first, but the end will not come right away." Then he said to them, "Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes, famines, pestilences in various places, and fearful events and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will lay hands on you and persecute you. They will deliver you to synagogues and prisons, and you will be brought before kings and governors, and all on account of my name. This will result in your being witness to them. But make up your mind not to worry beforehand how you will defend yourselves. For I will give you your words. I will give you words and wisdom that none of your adversaries will be able to resist or to contradict. You will be betrayed, even by parents, brothers, relatives, and friends. And they will put some of you to death. All men will hate you because of me, but not a hair of your head will perish. By standing firm, you will gain life."
Bless you. Thank you, Hazel. And thank you, choir. Try not to step in any of these bags while I'm up here today. That could prove disastrous. We gather today just like every other Sunday. Some of us do anyway. And we gather in a land and a place where we not only are allowed to gather, but we're encouraged to do so. We come to this place for a variety of reasons, and we offer forms of worship in our land, and hopefully more than just forms of worship. We offer them in places ranging from one-room storefronts to monumental cathedrals. Many persons marvel at the sizes of some of these places, like St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. Don't know if you've ever been there or not, but if you have, you know of which I speak. Or other places, large cathedrals, huge churches, some of them I call the Colosseums. But many people marvel at those, whether it's St. Patrick's or the big box churches that have sprung up in recent years. And for some, the size of the buildings, the size of the budgets, the numbers in attendance are indicative of the strength and or the spirituality of our church. Interestingly enough, some of the leading megachurches in this country have done studies in recent years which indicate that a large percentage of their attendees, and I call them attendees in this case, are no further along in their spiritual growth or their understanding of the Bible than when they entered the church anywhere from 5 to 10 years ago. In the text today, which is part of the temple sermon in Luke, Jesus has been confronted by some of the folks there with this great sense of pride concerning the magnificent temple, their temple budget, their regular stream of both regulars and sometimers. And they're not just speaking about the large stones, this huge edifice of the temple, but also about the ornamentals that were on the walls, the votive offerings, like the golden vine that was given by King Herod. Solid gold. They're admiring comments about the temple to Jesus and how wonderful the temple was and how wonderful the temple looked and how important the physical building was seemed to show for them an understanding that the spirituality of the people could be seen in the size of the edifice. Many of them had an edifice complex. And the various offerings that were there. Jesus looked around and looked straight at them and replies in a way that is rather shocking to much of the crowd that is there. And it might even be somewhat shocking to some of us as we read these words today. When he talks about the temple not being something that is really that important, the ornamentals, the structure itself, it did not show their spirituality. Of course, some Christians will chalk it up to Jesus' condemnation of some of the excesses of faulty religious leadership in what we call Second Temple Judaism. I can agree to a certain extent on that, but I would also submit that we can see and hear this scene repeated for us in the 21st century if we truly pay attention. Jesus gives a shocking prediction that this imposing temple structure that had stood for so long, with all of its ornamentals, stained glass windows, bandstands, media gadgets, which seemed to lend an air of superiority and permanence and spirituality, will one day fall and be nothing more than rubble. A theologian by the name of Richard Vinson, writing concerning the Gospel of Luke and this section, writes about the temple sermon and states that Luke shows Jesus with three major concerns here in this temple sermon. First, he is concerned to separate time from the time of God within Judaism, represented by the temple, and the time of the Gentiles, that time which was coming with the Christian church, the advent of the Christian church, with Jesus' own coming, that would extend to the end of the world, the end of the age. And that Jesus was wanting to distinguish what had come before and seemed permanent but would not be, and what would come after that faith that God was giving not only to the Jews but the Gentiles and would remain permanent as long as they endured. Secondly, Luke wants to show how Jesus predicted many things that the early church later experienced. This confirms Jesus' status as a prophet, and even more so as a Son of God, because he talks about these persecutions and being taken before synagogues and kings and governors, and all of that happens in the early church. And third, Luke chooses to make Jesus' final teaching here be a warning against the dangers of materialism. Luke overlaps it with a need to beware of being sucked in by the habits of the rich and famous. Just before this, though, Jesus had really blasted the scribes for their luxurious lifestyles, While on the other hand, many of them, especially the Sadducees, some of whom were wealthy businessmen, wealthy landowners, would destroy the lives of folks who had little, even would destroy the lives of widows. And as they're standing there, bless you, a widow comes and brings her two coins. You remember that story? She brings those two coins and drops them in, not from her excess, but from what little she had. And shows her commitment to God and to a life of worship, Jesus contends, even greater than the life that those scribes and Pharisees and Sadducees have shown. And as a result, she saves her soul. That commitment to God is what saves her soul. Now, while the temple here does represent luxurious living without necessarily having a corresponding lifestyle, of course, we have the ability to look back. We have hindsight. Hindsight's always at least 20/20. Because we know that in A.D. 70, the Romans do come in and pretty much do exactly what Jesus said about the temple. They wipe it out. They destroy it. Very few stones are left on top of each other. And yet, not only is it a warning for the people of Jesus' day, perhaps it is a warning for we in the 21st century. Because sometimes even our hindsight can blind us to the possibility that if we rely on our own self-righteousness, our lives may become just as much rubble as the temple did. Now you might say, hold on, time out. Jesus is really talking about the destruction of the temple for them and the end of the world for us, right? Actually, Jesus is speaking of the time leading up to the doom of the temple, the destruction of the temple, the appearance of false prophets, wars, rebellions, earthquakes, famines, and diseases do not necessarily mean, though, that the end of the world is near. Perhaps just the end of our world as we know it. These are regular occurrences throughout human history, are they not? Unfortunately so. What Jesus may be saying here is that how one lives all of life in connection with God will allow that person to persevere and endure whatever life throws at them, be it false prophets, wars, rebellions, earthquakes, famines, diseases. Because he talks about at the end here, those who endure will save their souls. They will gain their souls. But is endurance the only or even the primary goal? I think not. Because Jesus' words in verse 12 and following talk about persecutions, about being carried before synagogues, before kings and governors. But the purpose of the persecution is not to signal the end of the world. Jesus indicates the purpose of persecutions is so that we might have opportunities to do what? To bear witness to God in Jesus. Notice Jesus says here, these persecutions and all don't mean the world's going to end. There's a lot of stuff that's going to go on before the world ends. But what does he say? It will give you an opportunity to stand before the kings, the governors, the others who would persecute you and give a witness, give testimony for God. Testimony not just about salvation at the end of the world, but testimony to Jesus' life and the life that Christ brings us to live through the difficult times of war, the difficult times of disease, the fact that Jesus is there to help us through poor economic times, questions about God, questions about why we are Christian, questions about why we do what we do. Am I saying that perhaps these questions that are raised to us from others or maybe come to us from within ourselves are persecutions? Yes. They function just as those other persecutions might in causing us to have doubts, in causing us to raise questions that trouble us to the point that we give up. Because after all, is that not the purpose of persecutors? To get us to give up on what we believe. Oftentimes we seek to avoid questions because they make us uncomfortable. Maybe we become nervous or scared, like what we imagine persecution would bring, but we are to give that witness, not just clam up or change the subject. We will come in a few moments to celebrate and remember Jesus' sacrifice for us. And yet, it is not just for us to celebrate here and keep it within. It is to allow us then to be reminded that Jesus commissions us to go out and share the good news of His sacrifice, perhaps with family, maybe with our best friends, maybe with co-workers or people at school. Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, in A.D. 112, wrote a letter to the Emperor Trajan about interrogating Christians. I've mentioned this before because it is in that letter that he says he decided to do it by torture, and so he tortured two of their female officials who are called deacons. But after that, he wrote that he would ask if a person was Christian, and if they said yes, he said, "I asked two or three more times, threatening death if they did not recant. Concerning many who refused to deny Christ, even in the face of death," Pliny writes, and I quote, "Thereupon the usual result followed. The very fact of my dealing with the question led to a wider spread of the charge, and a great variety of cases were brought before me." Those early Christians faced that persecution, even death, and when faced with it, they stood firm. They endured the persecution, they endured the wars, the famines, they endured the threats of death in order to continue to spread the gospel even further so that more were arrested. When we are hated, when we are betrayed, or when others ask hard questions, or we run into difficult circumstances in life, when we are ridiculed for being Christian, Christ says we are expected. It's not an option. We are expected to use the opportunity for telling our story of Christ and our story for Christ. And for those who ask, and we're to tell that story even for those who ridicule. We are to speak words of wisdom, God's wisdom. While we might pay a price for our loyalty to Christ, God will give us grace not only to endure, but to have life both now and for our future. One of my former professors, Dr. Malcolm Talbert, writes, "Although men can take their lives, they cannot rob believers of their ultimate security. They will gain their lives, not their physical existence, but life in the age to come." End of quote. By endurance, Jesus says, they will gain their souls. It's not just a one and done thing, by the way. I mean by that, it's not just we walk down the aisle, we shake hands with the preacher, we get dunked, poured, sprinkled, and it's one and done. It's daily. It's daily. We are approaching Thanksgiving. I think we probably got that message the last couple of weeks, but we'll continue to do so because we are approaching that time where we celebrate Thanksgiving in this country, a time when we focus on being thankful predominantly for what kind of blessings? Material. We are reminded, though, in these words of Jesus in the temple sermon in Luke, that material blessings will fade. Material blessings will pass. However, the more important blessing we have available is true life, gaining our souls, not just for heaven, but for the living of these days. Our living testimony given through wars, our living testimony given through poverty and disease, sharing the gospel with others, regularly giving and participating in the life of the church, is an enduring thanksgiving to God. In so doing, we verify that through Him, we are gaining our souls. Not just for the sweet by and by, but we're gaining our souls, our very lives, even here. Choir sang a while ago, "The King is coming. The King is coming." And yes, ultimately the King is coming. But if we are Christ's, the King has come. And the King continues to come in and through us as we share, as we endure, as we lift up, even in the face of difficult economic times, even in the face of disease, even in the face of ridicule, or even in the face of tough questions. We gain our souls by enduring and by endearing God's message to others. Our participation in God's church and our mission outside of this place is to be an enduring thanksgiving to God that verifies that through Him and through Him alone we gain our souls. Thanks be to God for that good news. Our closing hymn, as we come and as we prepare for our communion, this Thanksgiving meal, is hymn number 768, "My Savior, First of All." As we sing, may we reflect upon the words, but may we also reflect upon the fact that God not only saves us sometimes from ourselves, but saves us to share, to endure, to give to others that same good news that we receive from Him. Our altar is open for any decision that anyone would make on behalf of God and of yourself. Number 768, "My Savior, First of All."